This is Emily Blaster with the Oklahoma Oral History Research Program at the OSU Library. Today is Friday, September 27th, 2019, and I'm in Oklahoma City interviewing Linda Cavanaugh for the Oklahoma Women's Hall of Fame Oral History Project. Linda was inducted into the Oklahoma Women's Hall of Fame in 2017. Thanks for taking the time to talk to
me. Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Emily.
Yeah. Let's begin by learning a little bit about you. Could you tell me where you were born and where you grew up?
I was born in Norman, Oklahoma, but primarily grew up in Oklahoma City. My dad was an elementary school teacher. So after he got back from World War II, he finished his degree at OU and then started teaching in Oklahoma City, and that's where we moved.
What do you remember about Oklahoma City as a child? I know that the city's changed a lot.
Oh, I remember all the fun things.
Yeah, what did you like?
We lived fairly close to what was then Spring Lake Amusement Park. And I remember sitting on our front porch and watching the fireworks, you know, on special occasions that would come from Spring Lake. I remember going to Spring Lake and the Oklahoma City Zoo at a time, people my age will remember this, they had this old shipwreck in the monkey area, and the monkeys would always be playing on that. And so that was kind of an iconic memory for older folks of the zoo. I remember Oklahoma City being a friendly place, just like it is now. I remember, it's all fond memories. There are no bad memories of Oklahoma City.
How would you describe it to someone who's never visited?
Oklahoma City is a town full of opportunity with very friendly and compassionate people who make you feel welcome from the moment you set foot here, I hope.
So you mentioned that your dad was an elementary school teacher. Could you talk a little bit about your parents? What were they like? Maybe tell us any stories that you have about them or favorite memories.
I hit the lottery when it came to parents.
Yeah.
Because you have to remember this was the 1950s and things were still the way things were in the 1950s. But my dad, who came from a family of five boys, ended up having four girls. But I think the advantage to us is that because he came from a family of boys, he didn't know what to do with girls. And so he treated us like boys. In that, there was nothing we couldn't do and nothing that we weren't expected to do. So I think that was the ultimate gift that I got from both my mom and my dad. I remember when we were growing up, my mother came from a farm south of Norman. And so because he was a school teacher, the salaries were like they are now, not what they should be, what you would hope they would be. So he'd help my grandfather bale hay, my mother's father, bale hay. And so the four of us girls would be out there baling hay, primarily my sister and I'm the oldest, and my next sister, Sarah, because the other two were too young. But, you know, it was just everything was expected from you as a girl that they would expect if he'd had a son. So it was really a wonderful gift.
Yeah, I'm sure that was.
And because he was a school teacher, we got to travel all summer long. He would, he built this contraption that went on the top of his old Buick LeSabre. And we would camp for probably 6 weeks during the summer. And we went to all the national parks. We you know, on a teacher's salary, you don't stay in hotels and stuff, but we never felt like we didn't have money because they used it so wisely and exposing us to things that most people never saw, particularly at our age. So it was wonderful. We walked down the Grand Canyon when I was 10, and my next sister would have been 8, and we made it down and back. So
how many sisters?
Four sisters. Yeah. Okay. I'm the oldest, and there's a 10-year difference between me and the youngest.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you all get along?
Oh, very much. Yeah. In fact, three of us still live within a block and a half of each other.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then my other sister lives in Dallas.
What do you like to do together?
Everything. With one sister, I walk every morning or in the evening. If we don't make it in the morning, we walk about 2.5 miles a day. Family was always the most important thing to my mom. So birthdays were celebrated, Christmas, all the holidays. And so we still do that as a family. Even though there's close to 30 plus of us now, we still all get together for every major holiday.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, it's a great gift.
How would you describe yourself as a child? What were your hobbies? What were your hopes? And
I was kind of a tomboy. My sisters were the girls. They were the girly girls. Like for Christmas, they'd be asking for Barbie dolls and things like that. And I'd ask for chemistry sets and guitars and just never much of a doll person. But that was what was wonderful, is because my folks let us do whatever we wanted. And they didn't think it was strange that at the age of 9, I'd want a chemistry set or whatever, or that I didn't want dolls, or everything was just accepted as the way it was. And they didn't, I never felt any restrictions, nor did my sisters, I don't think.
Yeah, I think that's important. Mm-hmm. Did you write when you were younger?
I did. I loved to write. And I loved photography. And I may have gotten the photography from my mom, because she always had a black and white camera with her. And she was always taking pictures. And she would gift us a camera when we were fairly young, 7, 8, 9, and we could take our own pictures. So we all have our own albums of photographs that we took, you know, of these trips to the national parks and different places. So they also, we kept diaries and things like that, and accounts of where we'd been. So I think a lot of my writing, love of writing, love of photography, love of traveling, love of people, came from those early years.
Yeah. Would you write about your travels and things like that?
Yeah.
In your diary?
Mm-hmm.
What would you focus on? So I'm kind of thinking of how, as a journalist, you have to observe people and think about how people might act or something to...
Truly, at those early ages, you know, when I would keep a diary, it would be mostly a chronicle of where we went and what we did and that type of thing, not so much the people that were around me. That changed as I got to high school and college, where it was more a reflection of things that were going on around me. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that does.
I guess we all kind of evolve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when you were younger and in school, what were your favorite subjects?
I loved English. I hated math. I still hate math. I loved history. There wasn't anything I didn't like except math. Mm-hmm. And I was still horrible at math. But everything else was good.
Is there a particular book you can remember from childhood that you really loved or that made an impression?
My dad taught 5th and 6th grade, mm-hmm. elementary school. He was a principal for a time, but missed the kids. And so he would choose books and he would read them to his class out loud. And so he'd often bring those books home. They would be the classics, you know, Steinbeck and things like that. And he liked poetry. I can't recall the specific poets right now, but they always seemed to be a little above our grade level, but it made it challenging and interesting. I found that once I got to those subjects in school, I was kind of ahead of everybody else because of that.
Yeah. So when you were in high school, did you plan on becoming majoring in journalism after the fact, or what led you to OU and to study what you studied?
Truthfully, it happened because of my high school experience at Bishop McGinnis High School here in Oklahoma City. I was working for the student newspaper, and they were looking for someone to write, they called it their teen columns, and they were looking for kids from different high schools in Oklahoma City to write about teen activities that were going on. And so the journalism teacher asked me if I'd do it, and I did. And so I would write things for the Oklahoma City Times, which was the afternoon newspaper of the Daily Oklahoman. This was the time when newspapers were king, and everybody took the Daily Oklahoman, and most people took the Oklahoma City Times. They published twice a day, morning and evening. And so I wrote for that. And as a result of that, got a scholarship to the University of Oklahoma for journalism. And that's really what made me decide to major in journalism, because we had to pay for our own way through school. And I thought, well, gosh, if somebody's going to pay me a little bit of money to study journalism, I'll study journalism. And that's what I did. Otherwise, I think I would have been a school teacher, like my dad. Yeah.
So Did you have internships that that you enjoyed while you were in where you were in college?
Absolutely. And I credit those with being able to continue to find jobs that were good ones. While I was at OU, I interned for Red Book Magazine in New York, Red Book no longer exists. I worked for the Oklahoma Department of Public Safety and Public Relations. I worked for the Paul's Valley Democrat, which is a newspaper in Paul's Valley. While at OU, I wrote for the Oklahoma Daily, which was the student newspaper. I just took advantage of opportunities to learn about what I was doing. And so when I graduated from OU, a friend and I got our backpacks and backpacked around Europe for 8 weeks. And when I came home, I realized the only thing I really hadn't tried was television, because OU didn't have a television curriculum at that time. And so I went up to Channel 4 in Oklahoma City, and because that was just happened to be the television station my grandfather listened to all the time, whether it was on the radio or whether it was the actual broadcast of television. That's all that he was ever watched. And so I went up there and I went to the newsroom and I said, you know, I'd like to try television. He said, well, that's great, but you don't have any experience. I was talking to Jack Ogle, who at the time was the news director. And I said, yeah, but you know, if you don't give me some experience, I'm never going to have it. So we worked out this deal where I just kind of came up and worked for free. Now it wouldn't be possible, but you know, I would go out with the crews, I'd write stories and that type of thing. And so that gave me my start in television news. And then I got married to my husband. We moved to Charlottesville, Virginia, where he was working on his PhD in economics. And I worked for a television station there. And I did a talk show type thing. And then when we moved back to Oklahoma City, I worked for Channel 5 for a short amount of time. And when we would come back during the summers, Will would teach at Oscar Rose and I'd work for Channel 5. And then we would go back to Charlottesville, Virginia for the school year. And then that's when I would work for Channel 29. And so when we came back for good, that's when I went to work for Channel 4.
What year was that?
1977. Yeah. 77.
Yeah. So you've experienced a lot of first while at News 4. Mm-hmm. One of the first was you were one of the first female co-anchors, right?
I was the first. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, the mm-hmm. first. What was that like?
Ernie Schultz was the news director, and he called me into his office, and he said, we want to try something different. And I said, yeah, what is it? And he said, we're thinking about trying a co-anchor situation. And I said, okay, well, that sounds fine. And he said, well, we want you to do it. And I said, oh. And because I had been anchoring, I think at that point, it was either the weekends or the morning show. And he said, we don't know if it's going to work, but, you know, we want to give it a try. And so that's how it started. And I co-anchored with George Tomic for the 6 o'clock news and Brad Edwards at the 10 o'clock news. But I don't recall any problems or anything like that with co-anchoring. Being among the first women in a newsroom, however, mm-hmm. was not always pleasant. Pam Henry was the first female they hired. And Bob Dotson, who then went from Channel 4 to NBC News, and he did a lot of work for the Today Show, tells the story, because this was before I was at Channel 4, of them looking for a female because they knew they had to hire a female because the FDIC was all over, not FDIC, the FCC was all over television stations to start hiring females. And so he said they knew that they had to find somebody special, you know, to kind of take care of what they knew would be the tension in the newsroom because it was an all-male domain. And Pam Henry was the national polio poster child. And she had had a lot of radio experience. She worked for KTOK. And they hired her to be the first female in the newsroom. And she really kind of laid the groundwork for the rest of us who followed. But there was still tension in the newsroom, even when I first started there. The chief photographer really didn't think women belonged in the newsroom. And so we would go out on stories for the first 6 months and not even speak to each other.
Really?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But it really didn't bother me. I figured that was his problem and not mine, simply because of the background I'd had with my dad and mom.
Yeah,
so
I think that would make a big,
it made a huge difference.
If not the difference.
Yeah, sure. You're correct. So, but on the other, on the flip side of that, most of the men in the newsroom were just extraordinarily helpful and intelligent and creative. And these were the guys who really had written the book on television news, because they are the guys who started Channel 4 in the early 50s when there wasn't even a newscast. There wasn't even a news department. And they had this challenge of putting together a newscast. And so they're the ones who quite literally wrote the book on how to do television news in Oklahoma City. So I learned from the best. I was very lucky.
Yeah. And were you... did you do your own photography?
I did when I first started there.
Did you learn camera work?
Yes.
As well?
Yes. Yeah. But a lot of what I knew from still photography made a great transition to film, which is what they were shooting on at that time, 16 millimeter film, because I knew how to frame the shots. I knew how to tell a story visually. And so it was, I thoroughly enjoyed that part of it. And the interesting thing is now television stations are now going back to that, where reporters shoot their own stories, only they're calling it MMJs, you know, multimedia journalists who do everything. Well, it's the same thing we did, you know, 45 years ago. Yes, right.
And you've produced several documentaries. I wanted to talk
about
that. How did you get into doing that?
This was a time that it was possible because local television stations still had a lot of control over their airtime and when they could take time away from the network and things like that. So when a story came up that I thought would make a good story about Oklahoma, then I would pitch it and they would do it. And among the first was Red Soil to Red Square, where we followed Oklahoma wheat from our Oklahoma farmers quite literally to the tables of Russians.
Yeah.
And this was during a time when
in the late 80s, right?
Yeah, and things were still pretty tense between the two countries.
Yeah.
There was no doubt in our mind that our rooms were bugged, because we would be complaining about the shots we weren't getting and they weren't taking us where we wanted to go. And then the next morning, our guide, who was always with us, said, "Today we're going to a market," which is one of the things we talked about wanting to go to, but they had not been willing to take us. So we were one of the first, in fact, I believe we were the first non-network crew allowed in Russia after the dawn of Glasnost, which was their idea of openness. Mm-hmm. So it was fascinating.
Yeah.
I mean, to see the lines that people stood in for food, and it's not like they just stood in line one time. They stood in line for each different part of the process. They stood in line to be able to go in. They stood in line for their time to come up to go in. They stood in line to pay for it. It was just an incredible all-day effort to buy your food. And then you'd get in there and they'd be empty. You know, the meat cases were empty. The shelves were empty.
And they let you film that?
Yeah. I think that's why that turned out to be such a good documentary, because for whatever reason we had access that most other people hadn't had.
So did you feel like the integrity and truthfulness as best you could do it was upheld there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Because they had no control over what we wrote or did when we got home. But we had the visuals to support what we were doing and what we were showing. So it turned out to be a very nice project.
Yeah.
And then we did one called... Strangers in Their Own Land. That took us about a year. And a lot of credit goes to chief photographer Tony Stizza, who I worked with on virtually every one of these projects. He's brilliantly talented. And in television news, if you don't have the pictures, you don't have anything.
Right.
So he was critical to everything we ever did. And the challenge of doing strangers in their own land is unique in that you have to put yourself back in the late 80s and 90s when the casinos weren't around. The Native Americans in Oklahoma were still having quite a bit of trouble on various levels. And they didn't trust, if I can just say it this way, they didn't trust white people. And so it literally, oftentimes to get one interview, we would have to spend days with an Indian elder before he would agree to do it. And that's why it took a year to get this done. And we traveled so many back roads, you know, and things like that to find these people, that they finally let us into ceremonies that had never been videotaped before or recorded. So that was probably the most satisfying project I may have done, simply because it took so much effort and it was built on trust.
Yeah.
Which I appreciated.
Yeah, that's a really important part of producing a story like that too, that maybe, I don't know if viewers realize what goes in to that, just the behind the scenes
relationship. Trying to get it done.
Building.
Yeah. And probably the first thing I ever did that was noteworthy was this thing called Behind Kitchen Doors, where we took our cameras with health inspectors into restaurants and showed what was going on. Because at the time, health inspections weren't open to the public. So you could go into a restaurant that was closed down the day before and you didn't even know it. You didn't know what their sanitation problems were. You didn't know what their health violations were. But as a result of that series, they changed the law in Oklahoma City and made them open to the public. Now they're online. At that time, they made it hard for you to get them, but yes, they were open. You had to go down and ask for them at the county health department, but at least you could get them.
Did you get a lot of pushback?
Oh, yeah.
And how did you deal with it?
The station was very good about dealing with it because a lot of it involved advertising dollars.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah. And the station was very good about dealing with it. And there were some lawsuits. And the station was very good about dealing with those, and we did fine.
Did you ever feel personally threatened or unsafe as a result of any of the stories that you...
I didn't eat in restaurants for a long time, for several years after that.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, seriously, yeah. I did not. Mm-hmm. Personally, no, not from specific series or stories that I did. Not so much. The only time you feel a little bit unsafe is the nature of television news is it's a mass media, so it goes to everyone. And not everyone is sound of mind. And so there were some instances where people who were not sound of mind made threats and showed up at the television station and had to be arrested and things like that. So, there were times when you didn't feel safe.
Did you have to have a social media presence and do the whole Twitter thing and things like that? Because I know a lot of women in journalism kind of get a lot of resistance depending on what they do.
That was a later development. I'd say the last 5 years.
Yeah,
towards the end. Yes, you did have to. You required to. And just like you knew every morning what your ratings were, then they started showing you what they called the rocket shares. Of how you were doing in terms of the market, in terms of followers, in terms of how many people were following you, how many reacted to what you put on the air, on the social media, whether it was Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, whatever. So yes, it was required and promoted.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the unsound minds can come out through that.
You know, truthfully, I didn't have any trouble with that.
That's great.
I know, I was so lucky. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I know women who did, but luckily I did not.
Yeah, good. I want to go back to the 80s.
Sure.
Just a little bit. You also started a family with your husband, right? What was it like having the career you had and raising your kids?
We were lucky because my husband taught at the University of Oklahoma. And we waited to have kids until I had some control over my schedule. And I had a contract that said what shows I was going to do. And that included the 10 o'clock news, which it was at that time considered the top moneymaker. Mm-hmm. And so I knew I'd be working approximately 2 to 10. And so Will was able to schedule his classes in the mornings. So we never had babysitters. So I took care of the kids in the morning, and then Will would be there in the afternoon. It was a whole different time, though. Pregnancy leave didn't happen. Family leave didn't happen. I had my son Paul on a Wednesday. I was at work when I went into labor, and I had him 3 hours later. And then I was back at work Monday. So there just wasn't a family leave. There wasn't anything like that. But because I had Will, he would bring Paul up for me to breastfeed him. And the people at the station were great. You know, they would play with Paul, and they enjoyed him being around and that type of thing. But it was a different world, mm-hmm. That's for sure.
Yeah. Did you ever feel like you had experienced resistance from maybe your colleagues, or maybe just even within yourself? It's a mother who was working in this time where there were changing ideas about the role of women in the workforce.
And so your question is?
Were there any difficulties you encountered at work that you feel resulted from being a mother?
I think that the way I handled it prevented those problems.
Yeah.
If I'd tried to take off 6 weeks or 12 weeks, it would have been adios amigos. Mm-hmm. You know, but because I had Paul on Wednesday and I was back on Monday, there wasn't much they could say about it. And it just wasn't. Jane Giroux and I are good friends, and we were having breakfast the other day, and it was just a different culture. You didn't think anything was wrong with what we were doing simply because that's the way it was done. You know, you didn't expect to have leave because there was no leave. I think that we helped move that along by the way we handled the issues that are now being resolved. It took 50 years, but by golly, we got there.
Yeah. Okay. I wanted to go back to documentaries.
Sure.
We were talking before we started filming about the ways sometimes we can hear about major events or traumatic events that are happening at home. So in 95, you were working on a documentary in Vietnam.
That's right.
Right? So could you tell me?
Yeah. Tony Stizza, again, chief photographer, Tony Stizza and I had pitched this idea of taking a prisoner of war, an Oklahoma prisoner of war, back to Vietnam to mark the 25th anniversary of the fall of Saigon, which was, in theory, the end of the Vietnam War. And in Oklahoma, as it was across the nation, it was a horribly painful war, very controversial. And the men and women who served there were not greeted with open arms when they came home. And so we found a POW, Dan Glenn, who was from Norman, Oklahoma, living in Norman at the time. And I called him up and asked if he'd be willing to return to Vietnam. And he was very pleasant, very nice. And he said, no, I would not be interested in returning home. I mean, returning to Vietnam. And so I left it at that. And a few weeks later, he called me and he said, I've given this some more thought and I would like to go. And so we made the arrangements that needed to be made to get into North Vietnam and South Vietnam. And Tony and I, Dan Glenn, flew over there. And it was a remarkable experience. We were flying into Vietnam, and you could look out the window and you'd see all these beautiful little lakes just all over. I said, Dan, look at all those lakes. And he said, those aren't lakes. He said, those are bomb craters that have since filled with water. And so we landed and we got to our hotel and started the process of shooting this documentary. And our goal had always been to show how the Vietnamese people were reacting to it, to this 25-year anniversary, and what had happened in that country, and then compare it to what had happened in our country through the eyes of people like Dan Glenn. And so one of the things we did was we wanted to take Dan to the what was called facetiously by the prisoners of war, the Hanoi Hilton. It was the prisoner of war camp in Saigon. I'm sorry, Hanoi. And it was horrific conditions there. The men were starved, they were tortured, they were beaten. Dan Glenn was shot down. He was an Air Force pilot a couple of days before Christmas. And by the time he got down to the ground, the Vietnamese were already all over him and kicking him and beating him. And he ended up pretty quickly in the Hanoi Hilton. And he recounted the tortures that they went through. But what stands out to me from that whole filming was we became the first television crew allowed in the Hanoi Hilton since the end of the war. And we, the morning that we went there, and we had requested over and over again to get in. And so we stood outside of this prison for 8 hours without anybody coming to let us in. And, you know, there was negotiations going on between our translator and whoever was in charge of all this. And 8 hours later, they came and they, with a key that barely fit in this rusted lock, and opened it. And they swung the gate open. And I remember Dan walked, there was this courtyard in front of us, and he walked straight to this building that was kind of in front of us and to the right. And I said, "Where are you going?" And he said, "This is where they first took me. This is where they tortured us." And so we went in there, and you could just feel the evil in it. Even if I didn't know that's what, you know, I think sometimes those presences remain in a building or in a place. Not only oftentimes good things, but sometimes the evil. And you could just feel it. It was creepy. And Dan stood there a while, and he was looking around, and he started crying. And I said, "Let's step outside. Let's get some fresh air." And so we stepped out, and I said, "Just take your time." He said, "I said, I can't imagine what happened to you in here, but, you know, we'll stop filming, do whatever you want to do." He said, no. He said, you don't understand. He said, "These are tears of joy. I'm remembering the tremendous love that we as fellow prisoners had for each other, and that's how we survived." And all the time, these tears are streaming down his face. And I just thought it was so remarkable that he spent 5 years in this place and came away with that one good memory, that's what he chose to focus on. So I have learned so much from people that I've had the pleasure of working with in telling these stories, that it's just remarkable. It's just remarkable to me. Yeah. The strength of Oklahomans and the strength of people. And that kind of happened again when we did a documentary called Tapestry, which was the story of the Oklahoma City bombing a year later. Soon after the bomb, well, coincidentally, this kind of goes back to the Vietnam story, we were in Hanoi, and it was the middle of the night, and in Hanoi they had these credit card devices that you would put into this holder at the door that turned on the electricity. And it would turn it off as well. And so I guess from the night before, the television set was on. And so during the middle of the night, the television set came on. I went, here's what happened now, I recall. I needed light in the room. So I took the card, I put it back in the card holder near the door, and the lights came on and the television came on. And as I'm making my way to the bathroom, I hear this familiar voice and I think, oh my goodness, who is that? You know, I think I'm sleepwalking or whatever. And it's Tara Bloom from Channel 4 here in Oklahoma City. And I get in front of the television set, and all I'm seeing are this panel of men and some women, and then cover shots of this building where the front of the building is gone. And I'm picking it up, of course, midstream. It's live coverage, but I don't know how long it's been on or anything else. But they're talking about how they suspect now that it was a bomb blast, and they're talking about survivors, and they're talking about fatalities. They're, you know, it's still very early hours of it. And so as I'm watching, obviously I know now it's in Oklahoma City, so I call Tony Stinza on the phone upstairs, and I said, "Turn on your television." And so he turns his on, and then they say they identified as the Murrow Building. And so I called the television station, and they said, "Get home." And so we started the process of getting home. But keep in mind, this is still a communist country we're in. And we have filed a visa that says when we're coming and when we're leaving. And they don't want us to leave except on that day, which is still several days past that Wednesday bombing. And so our translator went with us to the airport, and we had to empty our pockets of money to bribe them to get out, but that's how we got out and flew back to Oklahoma City. I guess we arrived on Friday then. The bombing happened on a Wednesday morning, Oklahoma time, and then we got back Friday morning. But what also stands out to me is coming back at all the places we stopped, these international places, the people looking at our passports would see we're from Oklahoma, and they would all say, "We're so sorry. We can't even believe something like this happened." The outpouring of compassion, even in a world filled with terror, even at that time, was remarkable. And every headline of every newspaper for every place we went, whether it was, you know, Hong Kong or London, wherever we happened to be stopping, and I don't recall specifically that we were in London. I do recall Hong Kong. That's what the headline was about the Oklahoma City bombing. And so we got back on Friday, and I got in Friday morning, and then we were on the air continuously for the next several weeks, commercial free.
What was that like for you?
To see what had happened in Oklahoma City.
Yeah, just all of it, just emotionally. How do you get yourself together enough for the air to really?
I just thought it was so ironic that my family and friends were all so worried about my safety in, you know, Vietnam, and here the danger happened to be in Oklahoma City. And of course, my concern immediately after I saw was brothers-in-law who I knew worked downtown and stuff like that. So I made calls and made sure they were all right. My daughter, it knocked over file cabinets in her elementary school 10 miles from downtown. So it was a significant and horrific event. Because I was on air, I never got to the bombing site for more than 2 weeks until they took down the Murrah building when they did that final demolition. And that was the first time that Devin Skillion and I were downtown by the... It was almost as though we were reporting on something that could have happened 100 miles or 10,000 miles from where we were, because we were looking at live feeds, but we were not at the scene. You know, we were not at the place. So that was the first time I'd seen it. And it was a nightmare. Yeah. It was just a nightmare. So it was terrible. And the most difficult part was when we were doing live coverage of the whole thing was difficult, but the most difficult part was probably the live coverage of the memorial service at the State Fairgrounds. And we were live down there, and you would see, they brought all the family members and relatives in, and it was a never-ending line of people who'd lost someone. And it was just mind-blowing.
Yeah.
Truthfully, heartbreaking. So I thought it was important that we document what happened to some of these people in this year journey to the first anniversary, and that's what we did. We followed Susan Walton, who was said to be the most seriously injured victim who survived. She had, I think, 27, 28 surgeries. And we've remained close. Bless her heart, you know, now it's 25 years later. And the body parts they put in are failing. So she's having to redo everything that was done 25 years ago as we're getting ready to mark that anniversary. So I learned a lot about optimism and strength and hope from people who on paper would have very little reason for any of those three things. Remarkable people. And I think that kind of characterized many, if not most, of the victims and our response to them. It was a historic event, in that it was the first time that there was 24-hour coverage, not because of its importance, although it was certainly important, but because of our ability to do it. They had what was called a satellite city set up, and all the networks were there, local television stations from many of the surrounding states, all of our cameras and all the local stations. But it was the first time you had the technology to broadcast around the world 24/7. And that's what we did.
Yeah.
And it was the first time that the Associated Press sent out a digital photo. And that was the Oklahoma City bombing. And we interviewed the photographer, and forgive me that I can't remember his name at this moment. And he had the first digital camera, shot the first digital photos, and went back and put those online. It was the first time, which is why I didn't know at the time, which is why we could see pictures in these newspapers in far parts of the world because of this digital effort. So those were the first photographs ever sent by digital means of a major news event. Still photographs I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was a remarkable technology event, technological event, and a remarkable human event.
Yeah.
And they all came together to tell that story, which is why I think the story was so well told around the world. I mean, because there are bombings and there are horrible tragedies around the world, whether it's in the Middle East or wherever, but all of a sudden, the focus is on this live coverage of this community 24/7 and how people are responding and how it's developing. And of course, with McVeigh's arrest, the whole thing, it was like a continuing soap opera.
Yeah. How was it like covering him?
He was a bizarre individual. I was the only reporter from Oklahoma City to see his execution. And it's not something, in fact, it was traumatic for me to witness this whole thing. They took, I think there were maybe a total of 8 of us, and again, I'd have to go back to my notes to remember specifically. But they put us on a bus. The only thing that we were allowed to take in was a notepad and the pencils they gave us, nothing else. And they took us into this waiting area. It was kind of a U-shaped execution. What's the right word even? Facility. His family, I believe, was to my left. We were at the long part of the U. On the right were representatives of families who'd lost somebody. And of course, the whole thing was televised back to Oklahoma City by closed circuit to family members who went to the, I believe, the FAA center to watch it. And so we were taken into this room. There's this big glass pane in front of us. And at 7 o'clock in the morning, the curtains came apart and McVeigh was already on the gurney, hooked up. And then they had some trouble with the feed back to Oklahoma City, and they wouldn't proceed with the execution until they got that feed right, because there was a camera directly over him to show him. And that took several minutes, and they finally got that done, and then they started the drugs. But before that, he would, and this is something he would also do at the trial when I was in Denver covering the trial, he would look at you and just dare you to look away from him. This is the best way I can describe it. And it was almost a battle of wills on who was going to look away first. And so he looked at everybody standing from the media. That's all I can talk about. I don't know what eye contact he made with anybody else. With all of us representing the media who were in front of this glass window. And it was curious to me that the people who had no experience with him described it as being he was looking for compassion or something as he looked at them. You guys were not at the trials. You did not know what was going on. But it's just curious that people's impression of what happened during that execution was colored perhaps by their lack of knowledge about what had happened previously with him. And I'm not saying whether or not he should be executed. I'm not saying, you know, it's just...
That's what happened and you were there.
And you learn a lot by having been at the trial. I was at the trial for McVeigh and for Nichols, and recall delivering the verdict live because they wouldn't let cameras in the courtroom Mache, Judge Mache, was very strict about that. So what we did is we had a reporter who was in an ante room listening to the live proceedings, and we couldn't have live coverage from the courtroom. And it was Lance West. And so Lance had a phone line back to the television station in Oklahoma City that was redirected to my earpiece. And as Mache would talk and as the jurors would talk, Lance would relay everything word by word to my earpiece. And so I could tell viewers what was going on, and I could tell them what was being said and that type of thing. And so when it came time for the verdicts, Lance did the same thing. And he said, on count one, you know, count two, and he went through the whole thing. And that's how we got the verdicts out within 5 seconds of it being read in the courtroom. So lack of technology requires, I mean, lack of access requires you to think of how you can use technology.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's how the verdicts unfolded. Whew, that's a long time ago.
Yeah. This is kind of moving us up in time. So you've won awards for your coverage of the bombing, and then also of the 2013 war tornado. And this is another thing we were talking about before we started recording, just the weather here and tornadoes and what happens when things go terribly,
terribly wrong. Yeah.
Like that. What was it like covering that?
Mike Morgan had warned us that this was going to be a bad day. And so the way the studio is set up, we were in the old studios, the old Channel 4 studios at the time. Our anchor desk was, depending on your perspective, when I'm sitting at the anchor desk, Mike's weather room was to our right. And Jim Gardner was up in the air. I believe it was Jim. Boy, I'd have to check that. It could have been John Welch, but you cover so many of these tornadoes, you lose perspective.
Yeah.
It could have been John. Yeah. Let's check that out, because I don't recall. I think it was John. And Mike was saying that this is going to be an F5, and people need to take cover. And if you haven't taken cover now, find a way to do it. Do something. And later stories would tell us that people were pulling up manhole covers and jumping in. I mean, it was just a horrific storm. And the helicopter was over it, and it was following it in, and then it was following the path as it happened, and it was just brutally horrific. You had, from the air, I think you had even a better sense of what was going on than the people who were on the ground, the emergency personnel, because we could see the whole city of Moore, and you could see everything that was going on. And then I can remember, it was John, my apologies. We were watching video, and John was shooting something, and he said, you know, the school's over there. I said, John, pan to the school. And he panned over the school, and that's when we knew we had serious problems. Any fatality related to a storm is terrible, whether you're an adult or a child. But to think that children were going to be involved was particularly heart-wrenching. And that's kind of the way it unfolded. And Lance West was on the ground, and the way he got in as quickly as he did is they followed emergency vehicles who kind of made their way through the rubble, and they were in a station vehicle, and they stayed right on their tail and followed him in. And he got to the school, and he started reporting live about it, and he knew that there were going to be fatalities, and he broke down so to the extent where he couldn't talk.
Yeah.
And so we kind of talked him through that, and he got the information out that we needed to get out. And so our coverage, like with the bombing, continued until there wasn't any more information that we could give people that they didn't need, and they did need the information.
Yeah.
So that was, it's not the way you want to win a national Emmy, but it did. The cover, we were we were firing on all cylinders that day. Everything worked out in terms of being able to tell viewers what they needed to know, helping law enforcement and IMSA, because of our helicopter being able to show things, ways that they could get in that they might not have seen. And I think we provided what television news is supposed to be, a public service that day. Yeah. So I'm proud of that coverage.
Sure.
Yeah. Don't want to do it very often.
Right. Yeah,
prefer never to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just personally, how do you kind of compose yourself or just recover emotionally from these things you witness and you talk about?
It's when you're on the air, you're so busy trying to, you've got 14 people talking to you in your ear and through what we call the IFB, it's your intercom system. You've got the visuals transpiring in front of you, and yet you're supposed to be the person guiding this coverage to wherever it's supposed to go. So really, during the coverage itself, there's not a lot of time for emotion. Mm-hmm. And I hope that doesn't sound horrible, but it's the only way you get the job done.
Yeah.
It's like a nurse or IMSA or something like that. You know, the emotion has to come later because you've got your hands full. When it's over, there are a lot of tears, and there's just sometimes a lot of angst. Mm-hmm. And you just deal with it as best you can. After the bombing and after some of these other events, they offered to bring in counselors, which some people took advantage of. And because it's traumatic. It can lead to PTSD, depending on what you've seen. And in the studio, we're fairly insulated from actual on the scene trauma, but some of those photographers and reporters were not. So it can be a very difficult profession.
Yeah.
But I think I worked with some of the best in the industry, whether you're talking about Oklahoma City or the nation. Mm-hmm. Just gifted people, compassionate people.
Yeah.
Lucky. I felt very lucky.
Was there ever a moment with a story you were covering where you just said to yourself, I can't do this?
When we were doing the State Fair Memorial that First Lady Kathy Keating had organized, as all those people walked down, I mean, the tears just started flowing and I couldn't stop them. But luckily, the camera was not on me, as it should not have been. It was on what was happening with the families and stuff. And you could hear the singing and stuff like that. So I had enough time to compose myself. But you don't check your emotions just because you're on the air. You just have to learn how to deal with them. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We've talked a lot about your accomplishments and the highlights of your career. Is there anything else that we haven't talked about that you'd like to mention in terms of an accomplishment, something you feel proud of?
I think I happened to be in the right place at the right time. Mm-hmm. You know, as far as being even the first female, I think it all was started when I was a kid in my house, mm-hmm. You know, because my parents brought me up that way. So I never thought it was an unusual thing for me to be doing. I still don't. Mm-hmm. I just think that I was capable of doing it, and so I did it. Am I proud of anything? I'm proud of being able to look on the documentaries we did and being even now pleased 25 years later, even though the technology and everything else has changed, the photography, the writing, the concept, the people we interviewed hasn't. So that's gratifying because I'm kind of a perfectionist. And I'm sure Tony Stizza could tell you that it was not always easy to work together because he was a perfectionist too, but he was more concerned about the video and I was more concerned about the words fitting the video and that type of thing. But that's why we made such a good team. I just feel lucky. I think that I won the lottery in so many respects, from my parents, from my upbringing, from my experiences, from the people I got to work with. Channel 4 literally had the best people in the nation. Oftentimes. And to be able to work with them, particularly in those early years, I mean, I stood on their shoulders on anything else ever I did. It was because of them.
Yeah. What do you think you learned about yourself as a journalist over the course of your career?
That I enjoyed the challenge. I learned that I enjoyed the challenge, and the bigger the challenge, the more I enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. If somebody said it couldn't be done, that was my signal that we'll find a way.
Yeah.
and not in a bad way. I mean, because they had said that we would never be able to do what we wanted to do with the Indian tribes.
Yeah.
We were able to do it. And a lot of it was just the upbringing that we had, that a lot of this wasn't done on the time clock. I mean, it was our own time. It's because I loved doing it. I loved seeing the visuals come together with the words, and I enjoyed the storytelling, and I enjoyed meeting the people. And I think I became a better person by knowing the people that I did stories with. I thought, my gosh, if they can make it through that, what complaints do I have? Or, you know, if that guy can be that courageous in those situations, I've got no complaints.
Yeah, and it gives you a different way of looking at an obstacle.
Absolutely.
Or failure. What do you think about failure? In terms of maybe what you learn from it.
The only people who ever fail are those who don't know how to get back up. Mm-hmm. And I guess failure could be when you call somebody to do an interview and they say no, and you accept that. That's failure. Mm-hmm. If you don't accept it and you find a way to make it where they want to do the interview and they see a purpose and they see a reason and they trust you, then that's not failure. You know, the first no, if you accept it's failure, if you keep going, that's not failure. So, and as you keep going, people learn to trust you. And you can call somebody up and you'll say that, you know, I'd like to do a story. And they'll say, okay. And you don't have to go through all the gaining their trust because you already have it. And that's the most critical part of any story. Yeah.
So in retirement.
Yeah.
What's it like? What do you like to do?
I find that I'm busier now. The
really?
Only difference is I get to choose what I want to do. Mm-hmm. People seem surprised that I miss being on television, but I don't. Television was never the draw for me. People were always very nice. I was very lucky in that respect. There was, except for the one or two wackos, people were always just, they welcomed you into your home, into their homes, and as long as you respected that, they felt like you were a member of the family. And people still are so very kind to me, and I'm grateful for that. So I don't miss being on television. And if I chose to, I think I could do projects again. I'm just not ready.
Yeah.
You know, after 40 years, I just needed I needed to breathe.
Are you still doing photography?
Yes, I am. I do. I like to paint. I like photography. I like gardening. I like traveling. Mm-hmm. I still do a lot of charitable things. I do things that I think will help people.
Is there a place you'd like to travel to that you haven't been to yet? That maybe you'd like to go to one day?
Yeah, every place I haven't been, I'd like to go to.
But you have a singular area you've always said to yourself, you know, I should go to such and such country.
You know, I can travel 90 miles from here and have the same thrill I get from traveling 900 miles or 9,000 miles. It's meeting the people. It's seeing different things. It's getting a new perspective on your own life. That's the benefit I see from travel. It's not the luxury of it. Mm-hmm. It's just the experience of meeting new people and seeing new things. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it kind of goes back to your childhood.
Yeah, stories. I think so. Yeah. Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Adventure.
Yeah, that's okay. Right.
The new experience.
And so travel can be from here to Norman, as far as I'm concerned, we're going to South America here in a couple of weeks. Because my daughter married a guy who is from Argentina. He lives in the United States now, but his family's still there, so we're going to visit them. So it's just it's a much smaller world than when I grew up. Mm-hmm. When I went to the University of Oklahoma, my grandfather lived probably 6 miles south of the campus. I mean, he could hear, when he was out farming, he could hear the stadium yell with people watching the game. But yet it's still a long distance phone call from Norman, Oklahoma to his farm 6 miles away. So sometimes my greatest astonishment as in this world my kids are growing up in is that distance means nothing. It was a big deal if I was going to go to a wedding in Ardmore from Oklahoma City. They fly to weddings around the globe. And when my daughter got married this last summer, she had people there from 15 different countries.
Wow.
And I think that's a good thing for all of us. But I think that's my biggest amazement. It's not so much the technology. Of course, it's the technology that makes it possible, but it's the shrinkage of the world. I think we're finally beginning to realize we're all in the same mess.
Yes.
Yeah. And we got to work on it together. That's right. Yeah.
We haven't talked much about mentors in your life that have made a difference. Are there any mentors that you would like to mention?
Absolutely. Yeah. All of the guys who were at Channel 4 when I first got there, Ernie Schultz, the news director, George Tomek, an anchor, Brad Edwards, one of my favorite people of all time. He has since passed away. But these were all guys who just were willing to share what they knew so that I didn't have to make the mistakes they made. And that's what I tried to do then for men and women who came afterwards, is to just help them not make the mistakes I made so they could go on and make other ones and just kind of make their journey a little easier and faster. But these guys taught me how to write. They taught me how to make sure your words matched, not matched the video, but augmented the video, because the video is what tells the story. My words need to stay out of the way, but somehow convey a little more information than perhaps the video did. They taught me everything I knew. So from all those early guys, and from Pam Henry, the first female reporter, and even the reporters I was working with the last 2 weeks I was there, you know, I learned from everybody, and I'm grateful that people were willing to share their wisdom or their insight about things. So mentors, everybody I ever worked with, and I hope that I returned the favor a little bit.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at things.
No, it was, I feel blessed. I really do for the whole thing.
You could have moved away from here plenty of times, right? Away from Oklahoma. What kept you here?
My family. My husband is from Duncan, Oklahoma, and his folks were still living. My family was and still is extraordinarily tight. And I did have the opportunity to leave. I had the opportunity to go with ABC News and different markets. But one of the other factors was here in Oklahoma City, I could do whatever I wanted. I could anchor, I could shoot film, I could write, I could edit. If you became an anchor in some larger cities, they had unions, and you couldn't even touch the equipment, for instance. And I liked the hands-on here. But the main thing was our families. They were here.
What words of encouragement would you give young journalists who are here in Oklahoma? What words of encouragement would you give them to stay here?
To stay in Oklahoma?
Yeah.
I think this is a great place to grow up and to raise children and to live your everyday life. You don't have to go to New York or Chicago to get the big stories. They're happening all around you all the time. My only advice to young people entering the industry right now is to take a second look at where the industry is going. When I was, for most of the years, there was this thing called the fairness doctrine, where you had to present both sides of every story at the same time so that people had the ability to make the decisions themselves. It's no big secret that that's not the case now. And that people often, I mean, the channels are so polarized that people often watch who they agree with, because then it makes them feel smart to think that somebody's on national television saying the same thing they agree with. Well, they're not expanding their mind. They're not understanding the nuances of the policies and the problems in front of us. And I think it's dangerous to our democracy. So that's my only advice to young people entering the communications field is to keep in mind that you're influencing not only now, but the future. And people have to have facts they can rely on to make their own decisions.
Yeah, some important advice. There's a historian, Angie DeBoe, she wrote something once that I think I'd love to know your thoughts on this. She said, "The one who can interpret Oklahoma can grasp the meaning of America in the modern world."
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. From our grassroots beginning, from the people who farm the land to the people who are developing technology that's not done anywhere else. I mean, we're a place of innovators. We're a place of faith and religion, no matter what that faith or religion might be or how you choose to practice it. We're a place where family still matters. And if you understand and grasp that, you also understand that it makes a difference in the rest of the country. I wouldn't be in any place but Oklahoma. If I could choose any place to live or any place to have been born, it would have been here. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's great. When you were notified that you were going to be inducted into the Oklahoma Women's Hall of Fame, what was going through your mind when that happened?
When I was notified that I was going to be inducted, I was very grateful and very impressed about all the people, the women in Oklahoma who made such a difference that I might be included in that group. Because if you look at some of the women who have been included, I mean, they are path makers in so many respects. And I think they're indicative of the type of women who made Oklahoma work. You know, whether it was the farm women who kept the farms going or whatever the case may be. It's just, I think we have a special gene, maybe, in Oklahoma women who just make things possible.
Yeah, I like that. So what advice would you give to women who may want to go into journalism or who may wish to follow in your footsteps?
I don't think they want to follow in my footsteps because the technology changes so quickly. They're going to be on their own journey. Mm-hmm. The only thing I can recommend is that they stay true to themselves, that they realize the only person they're ultimately responsible for is themselves. And they have to have morals, they have to have guidelines by which they are willing to do their work when no one is watching. And I think that's critical.
When history is written about you, what would you like for it to say?
Oh my goodness, that she cared about what she did. She cared about the people for whom she worked. And that would include all of our viewers or all of our readers or whatever the case might be. And that she wanted to leave things better. And I think in some small ways we accomplished that.
Yeah, leaving things better. I think that's a great legacy. Well, we've covered a lot. Is there anything else you want to talk about that we haven't addressed?
I'll talk about anything that you want. I'm particularly proud of the women in my family. My daughter, my nieces, my nephews, and I know nephews aren't women, but they all have a good sense of perhaps the wonderful differences between men and women, but not a sense that one is superior to the other. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think they all have a great sense of that, and I credit my sisters and my brothers-in-law with giving them that perspective.
Mm-hmm. Passing it down.
Yes, exactly. And my daughter has enjoyed great success, I think, more from watching those around her than any specific things we ever said to her. So I think we live by example, and we always have to remember that people are watching for better or for worse. Mm-hmm. Particularly, whether you're a mom or whether you're a school teacher or whether you're on the news, doesn't make any difference. People are watching.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, you did such a nice job.
Great.
Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure.
You did a great job.